or a blind person may think about, I don't know, sections in a very different way to a sighted person. Or maybe they'd think about it in the same way. It's just that no one's ever actually had those conversations.
Fitting and misfitting. If you're designing to enable people not to misfit. Start from difference rather than add difference.
Just arrived at London Euston Station, and now we're crossing the street to meet Joe's boys and Zoe Parkinson. We're meeting them at the Friends Meeting House, a non-commercial working space.
Hi.
Hello.
Hi.
So I'll start?
Yes, okay.
My name's Joss Boys. I've been working in the field of architecture in a very wide-ranging way for, I guess, 50 years, in that I studied architecture in the 1970s and 80s and was very involved in some feminist architecture work at that time through a practice called Matrix. So we were really interested in how you might understand how space was gendered at a time when that wasn't even up for discussion as something that you could talk about. And since then, I've worked in a variety of different ways, in a variety of different places, and as a single parent, I was, you know, worked as a teacher in architecture schools, so that I was earning a proper living, but mainly I've freelanced and done a variety of different things, including writing and different sorts of kind of community-based practice. And with Zoe, who we'll introduce herself to, over 10 years ago, we set up something that at that time was called Architecture Inside Out, with the idea that disability access and inclusion were still really badly dealt with within architectural education and practice, and that by using the creativity of disabled artists, we could really provoke new ways of working that were both very subversive but also very enjoyable.
And hi, I'm Zoe Partington, and I suppose I came into architecture probably 25, 30 years ago, as I did. I studied a postgraduate diploma in the history of art, design, architecture and philosophy. And one of the reasons for doing that was I'd done a qualification before, which was very practical, but the history and the context, lots of things were missing from that, which I really wanted to know about. So I did this, the sort of heritage and history side, to find out more. And as part of that, I suppose as a disabled person and as a person with sight loss, I began to realise there was lots of gaps in the way that I was being taught, but also in the way that things were designed or developed. And I didn't see any role models or any blind or partially sighted people or female blind or partially sighted people studying or developing architecture. So I sort of became, in a way, accidentally quite fascinated by it. I'd always done creative things as an artist, but I then moved into working in a very structured way with organisations in London, auditing and creating guidance around inclusive architecture, inclusive design, built spaces, buildings. And it very much came in line with the Disability Discrimination Act at the time. And because of that, I began to realise that people had been doing this for quite a long time and not much was changing. So I again began to challenge it and question it. And maybe because I was an artist or got a slightly different background to some of the access auditors and specialists I worked with, and all the people I worked with weren't disabled people as well, so that was also quite interesting. So I began to have lots of questions and look at it in a very different way. And then we met, didn't we, to help develop Set Up Architecture Inside Out, which was really about to look at how disabled artists may be able to influence changes in built environment, in spaces, and again, to critically map things and to look at things in very different ways. I suppose we've been on that 10-year journey, haven't we, trying to develop how we continue to embed that type of approach, which is more sort of moving away, isn't it, from guidance is important, but it doesn't answer everything, and guidance changes as things change and society moves and people's opinions.
And the guidance is very technical and functional and clinical. It's
not
become,
about people, is it, really?
Yeah, it's become this thing which stands for kind of disabled people as a category. Just not very... and, you know, coming from architectural practice and education, the whole atmosphere of it being kind of boring, politically correct, something you do at the end of your studies.
Yes. And it's never evaluated with disabled people that use the space, or spatially how that might work or not work.
Rebecca?
Yes.
Sorry, one of the artists that we worked with years ago.
Actually, what you say is quite true. Like, I have the feeling that in architecture school, we're just designing shapes, and then when we go into offices or work, then it became like, okay, we have norms and we have to fulfill some process, but we actually don't think about it. And during architecture studies, we don't think about it, or it's never open, this topic, somehow.
There's a really interesting disability studies scholar called Jay Dolmage. There's a lot of really exciting work in disability studies that doesn't really get into architectural educational practice, and he calls it retrofitting. So there's this very odd thing, which is you learn to design for quote-unquote normal people, and then you add on stuff
or you take out.
So it's a kind of it's built in as an afterthought, and I certainly, it sounds like your experience is the same. When you get taught design, that's exactly what's assumed.
Yeah.
It's like not that important. It's something you can deal with when you go into practice. It's a rather dull subject that you just need to know, like you need to know fire regulations.
Mm-hmm.
Completely dehumanizing.
Yeah, because you start with the Neufahrt, or you start with the modular,
exactly.
Or you start with all these normative, idealized bodies. Yeah.
You get all these ergonomic figures that are themselves quite problematic where they came from. And there's still, I think, really important histories to be written about kind of the development of notions of ideals or norms or averages. Mm-hmm. And there's real connections between those ergonomic studies and eugenics. I mean, there are real connections about trying to have this kind of normal dash ideal type, which are kind of not achievable. There is, none of us are average.
Well, with disordinary architecture, we're trying to look at how you really embed it as if it's in somebody's DNA, about how they then bring that into everything that they do. Not necessarily in a disability-specific way, it's not about that, but it's about understanding the varieties of people that may use a space or an environment, and understanding how you might work with a disabled person to look at it in a completely different way that actually might be better, but it takes quite a long time, doesn't it, to get people to think in that way. And I think now we've started to practice, or we've used workshops in quite interesting ways, and you can begin to see the change, I think, in some of those students that we've been working with. I think also there's something else that's happening, that younger people are now exposed to more disabled people, because as things get more accessible, more disabled people become visible. So people that have been isolated are now not so isolated. So people are beginning to question, aren't they, and challenge what is this norm, and how might we rethink about it or address it differently.
Yeah, and I do think that, you know, things like gender fluidity are kind of moved to being much more relaxed about gender binaries, and even, you know, gay lesbian type binaries, just to get much more relaxed about how fluid our identities and kind of ways of being in the world are. Taking that into disability and impairment for younger people who find that much more just the way of thinking about things. It's kind of easier. It just when we start talking about disability in that way, something that's very variable and creatively interesting in that variety. I think they get it a bit more.
Do you think the system that more disabled people enter the mainstream educational system has changed the notion of normality a bit?
again, it has for children and young people. Whether it has for the teachers, I'm not so sure. The mainstream school system is still very, very difficult for disabled people to flourish within it if the right setup isn't in place and the right framework. But there is a framework, and there is legislation, and there is law.
There's like assistants or like teachers are trained in.
You'd hope that, yeah. Ideally, yes, but sometimes they're still not trained in a way that they should be to make sure that a disabled person isn't still the object of everything's not working because of that person. Mm-hmm. And it's still very important to try and get the schools to understand how to, you know, how to change the system and the framework. That's the issue. That's where the barriers are, not within that individual disabled person that comes into that mainstream school. I mean, we talk about this within architecture, don't we? When we talk to, and I have to say, it's a lot of male architects that I have been talking to recently will talk about designing environments and that we have to design these environments for the masses because that's how we make things work. And we keep having these discussions around that able-bodied people can survive in any terrain in a way. So actually, as a designer, if you create not a very good design, non-disabled people can still use that building and that space. They might not like it, but you're definitely excluding disabled people, and you should be thinking about, you know, the 6%, the 8%, the 10%, because if you get that right and you work to make sure that those people can access it, and it's the same in education in the schools, then it will work for everybody and it would actually be better for everybody. But really trying to push that nugget and get people to understand that can still be quite difficult, I think. And people will argue for hours about it. And I'm thinking it's not that hard a sort of model to understand.
I agree. And it is part of the thing about the Disordinary Architecture Project is to try and think of ways, if you argue that you should start from difference rather than add difference on at the end as a kind of artificial thing, what does that mean in terms of the kinds of teaching that you do, the kinds of activities that you do, the workshops, how it affects how people literally learn the subject. Again, not just you need to know this about disabled people, but how you think about the world and your place and the place of other people in it. And some of the language that I use, again, from disability studies is around the idea of fitting and misfitting rather than, you know, able-bodied and disabled, that different sorts of environments act in different ways, different contexts. It's always relational. It's always about who you're with, what the space is like, what the attitudes are like. All those things come together in a relational way to disable or enable particular groups of people and not others. And because we have a society that goes on discriminating against disabled people,
which is the social model of disability.
Yeah, it is. It is the social model, but I think in a way there's been the social model is still really important, and one of the things, I know Zoe does this a lot, one of the things we do is explain the social model, which a lot of people don't know. But a lot of there's contemporary work by people like Alison Kafer who talk more about what they call a relational model. So that you're not... The social model, I think, is really important, the idea that it is the relationship between disabled people and the societies, and how societies frame it. Yeah. But the relational model tends to say that's very dynamic, that depends on all sorts of things at once, not just disability, but gender, race, class, all those things, and that it's specific and it's situated, so you need to understand what's going on there. And that if you actually design if you think about misfitting as a very creative thing, even though often it's, you know, something that's forced upon disabled people. But if you think of it as a creative thing, if you're designing to enable people not to misfit, then that's a real creative generator. That's not a problem. That's not a kind of leftover. It's what you start from.
Yeah.
So you don't get into this numbers game like it's not very important because there aren't many people who use a wheelchair. You get into what's the neuro and biodiversity, the richness of it, the value of it in our world, and how does that, if you think about those sorts of ways of existing, then how do you really support those?
Yeah, and I think that's the thing, because what it does, And this is why we want, obviously, a lot more disabled people to be training in architecture or visibly training in architecture and design and then getting employed in the architectural sector. Because that's the other issue, isn't it, about that transfer from education then into work, is that this whole flip side, that if a disabled person is designing and developing and controlling it, it aesthetically, it just becomes a very different way of designing those spaces and thinking about those spaces. A very small thing sometimes can actually change it. But it's also about people realising that disabled people aren't just wheelchair users. There's a huge spectrum of disabled people with different impairments. And how do we get people to open up to think this is much bigger than just people with mobility impairments or wheelchair users? I think it's still incredibly valid, but it's much wider than that. And that means more people in society have access and need to make sure that it's right, really.
One thing I really liked in the phone call we did before is the shift from feminism or from your feminist practice matrix. When the discussions you had there, that you said disabled studies had like a language already prepared for difference compared to feminism that at that time didn't have that language.
I think that what we do is a form of feminist practice, but I don't think that's a way we ever talk about it. And that's partly because it's almost like you can go beyond some of the things that we got very caught up in the 70s and the 80s. The things that were really important were to being able to just work out what it meant to say that space was gendered or racialized or queered or, you know, all those things, or disabling. You know, there was a kind of interest in that. But for me, it may be different for Zoe, I think there's been some really fantastic stuff by contemporary disability studies scholars and disabled activists and artists, which is around the idea that we're all after the same thing. It is all about, you know, the expression is transformative social, spatial and material justice. And the notion of justice rather than access and inclusion, for me, is a really powerful one because it does include power. And if you start talking about spatial justice, and spatial and material justice, if you're thinking particularly about architecture, I feel like that's it's not so much that you have feminism and then you add intersectionality. It is that you have a way of working which brings together feminists and disability scholars and, you know, queer scholars. It's all being interested in the same end, and then what you have to do in order to get there is exactly what Zoe was talking about, I think, which is about what are the everyday practices and spaces and relationships that make things gendered or make them discriminate against particular people, disable particular people, and that's across the board. You know, you can't just say, oh, well, women, you know, certain things will happen to certain sorts of women to do with their place in society. But once you start cross-cutting it with impairment, with sexuality, with race, it feels to me like it's better to look at the practices and see what they're doing to all of us, not to say, I'm a feminist or I'm a queer scholar.
I agree, and I think, because what with the social model of disability and the thinking in the 70s, what was really fascinating was to really start to look at how disabled people, impairment groups were segregated into each impairment group. So people were working separately and against each other. And that was convenient for other people because that meant that you know, those minorities couldn't work as a majority to change things. And then I think disabled people began to realise that it was not a useful way forward for disabled people, but to come together as a bigger group was going to give people more power and be more informative to other people. And I think, again, somewhere along the line, I think for some disabled people, they've sort of got trapped in that and not thought about the next stage, about how do we also then include other people that may be finding that, you know, they're dealing with barriers or missed opportunities for different reasons, but in a very similar way. How do we work together to try and remove them much faster and with more majority, really? And I think that's when it becomes quite interesting. And you really do start to, which I think you do see in young people, because they are having much more conversations about this than I ever did as a younger person. And I think, and we know that's a really, you know, it creates better environments for everybody. Like you say, that social justice, that spaces are for everybody. They're not just for one set of people, which some obviously are at the moment. But
yes.
But
I think the other thing about it is that, you know, again, just talking about it in the more kind of the kind of theoretical frameworks that are being developed, is that it's and within disability activism and scholarship as well as art practice, is that part of it is also accepting that there isn't kind of a solution. It isn't like, well, all you need to do is this and then it will be wonderful for women or it will be wonderful for disabled people. It is that whatever you do, it's going to go on being complex and contradictory, and it's never going to work for everybody. Mm-hmm. And that what you're trying to do is just move towards it being mm-hmm. better for the most disadvantaged people, mm-hmm. and that it is something that can only be. You do it, yes. It's, you do it.
It doesn't
kind of
stop.
A light.
It doesn't stop. I think that's the thing, isn't it? And one package is just not going to suit everybody, and it doesn't fix it for even those individuals. It's about how do you keep developing it, I think.
You're accepting that, you're bringing that into it and letting it just be part of what you do
and not be
kind of worried that you're going to end up with contradictions in what suits people, really. Or you try and resolve them, you know, you're always trying to resolve them.
So, as we already heard in our recordings, we are in this very lively place here. You said you regularly meet here.
When you asked about where we meet and whether we have an office and all of that, we don't have an office. We're very much an informal platform. And I think even when we get more consolidated, which is what we're in the process of doing now, we still don't need an office because people are based around the country. And at the moment, this particular road, the Euston Road, which runs west-east across this top half of London, central London, is a really good kind of zone for us because we're doing stuff at the British Library, we're doing stuff at the Bartlett School of Architecture, stations that Zoe and other colleagues come into, other artists come into at Euston, King's Cross, St Pancras, Marylebone. They're all on that road. So we find that there are also quite a lot of really interesting public buildings where we have our meetings. So there's a GP's place that we go to because it has a public cafe, and there's this, the Quaker's Friends House. What I like about the Quaker building is that it's quite old-fashioned. It's very open. It's not somewhere where you have to have a cup of tea or a cup of coffee. The Quakers are definitely people who, in their own way, have believed in social, spatial, material justice for a very long time. You know, just people do come and sit here because it's quiet. Public, nobody's going to send them away. We come usually because it does have quiet places. It turns out that what I thought was a quiet place today isn't a quiet place. You know.
Kind of drawing device to help her to explore non-visual representation.
Do you want to talk about the Architecture Beyond Sight
project,
which is what you're doing the audio tour tonight at the Bartlett School, and how you bring your ideas into this project, how you bring them forward?
Yeah, I mean, the Architecture Beyond Sight project has come out of a relationship with Bartlett, hasn't it, that we've been, well, and Joss has definitely been developing for quite some time. So it's come out of having more talks, representation from disabled people coming to talk about the work that they do with architecture students and design students, not just at the Bartlett, but at other architecture schools as well. The Dean, Alan Penn, at the Bartlett School of Architecture was also very interested because he'd met a blind architect and he began to think particularly about architecture, about how it's a very, or maybe it's taught in a very visual way, and he started to question that, didn't he really, Alan? And then came to Disordinary Architecture to look at how we might address some of that by making opportunities for blind and partially sighted people to be part of the student intake, so to be undergraduates and to be, and it can be at any level, it's not necessarily only at one level. So this is really a big start, a big journey to try and change practices and to look at how that's possible. We did a three-day pilot course, didn't we, last year? We tried to look at how the course or modules might be shaped, who within those structures that exist within the universities need to get involved to begin to unpick their thinking. Last year was interesting because suddenly blind and partially people were visible within that architecture school, and very, very quickly people could begin to see how you might do things in a different way, you know, purely because maybe four guide dog users would turn up to the project, or a blind person may think about, I don't know, sections in a very different way to a sighted person, or maybe they'd think about it in the same way, it's just that no one's ever actually had those conversations, and slightly tweaking things could make that possible. And I think that was really interesting, wasn't it, for us.
What are the methods you're working with? You were talking about the alternative, or like more open, like different drawing or model building methods that you develop for those workshops.
One of the things I think was really valuable about this initial 3-day workshop was that it was a mixture of blind and partially sighted artists, architects, Mandy, who working with us, who's a writer, as well as sighted architecture students and tutors. And so in working together, doing a kind of very quick 1-day design project, it was really enlightening to see the variety of ways in which people shared how you map or build a space, how you represent it, and how you communicate what you've done. The artist showed us techniques, for example, of sewing, or how easy it is to make a tactile line by just using a rubber mat. So one group shared their drawings where they were sketching on one side on the mat and then flipping it over so it made a tactile edge. So you could very quickly share a sketch. Carlos Pereira, who was the blind architect who came from Portugal to work with us, showed how he cut and folded card in really interesting ways. So he did a kind of three-dimensional model making. Yeah. You could see him imagining what the space would be like. And he also talked about how he does site visits, which was really interesting because it was about how you use touch and a very slow engagement with the place, with the smell and the atmosphere. So his site visits take 2 or 3 days of just really concentrated engagement with the space. And that felt like a really beautiful thing to do. That felt like something that'd be really nice for all architecture students to do, to me. Mandy and Charlotte, who she was working with, they did a kind of performative, they performed the site. So they were performing what they imagined designing in it, and they were walking around it as if what they built was there and talking about it. Zoe, you also did some audio description. We talked about whether you could design a building just by using words.
Yeah.
Could you do it? If you could describe it well enough so somebody could draw it up. And there's kind of an idea, well, if you can't, you know, do the CAD stuff, then you can't do it. But in fact, there's two things about that. One is lots of very famous architects, they just have the concept and they have other people who draw it up for them. Yes. And I think the other thing is, with the way that kind of online drawing is developing. So example, we found somebody who's worked for Richard Rogers, who indeed has sight loss and has never really told anybody. She's worked her way through architecture school. She's partially sighted and she's worked for very high-powered practices. Yes, and she finds that the computer-based, you know, parametrics and that sort of thing really works for her. With her particular impairment. So it feels like there are a range of methods that allow you to... And
I think that's been the important thing, isn't it, about how you then translate. So if someone has an incredibly good idea or approach to something, how that's developed, I'm not sure it matters, but then it's how you translate it, isn't it, to other people around you to make it work, really. And that is something that I think came out quite well last year. And then also you were saying about talking about audio description. We know when we've used audio description with students that people begin to look at space much more and they observe it more and they begin to see things that they've always walked past and missed. And just through changing literally from visual sketching or to using the computer, they suddenly have to... I don't know, the space becomes more real somehow and they engage with it. And I think that's important for everybody, not just for blind or partially sighted people. And that's when I think it becomes more interesting, because it isn't about blind people at that point. It's about communication, it's about observing, it's about... it's just about real issues, isn't it, that you're there as a person designing for other people.
It's really about, like, understanding in which kind of space you are and how people use it.
Yeah. And how I think kind of orthographic drawing, you begin to realise how much it leaves out, how much, because you can't, how do you describe smell in orthographic drawing? You don't. And how do you, and ergonomic drawings too. I did a very brief project with the Glasgow School of Art with first year students there, where they did start with ergonomic drawings, and then we looked at what the limitations were, and they began to do drawings of the experience of being having an impairment in different situations, and immediately saw that they couldn't really represent the things that mattered. They couldn't, if they were representing somebody who was partially sighted, then they couldn't capture, you know, navigating by sound, or they didn't have a mechanism for the things that really counted. So that became an exciting thing about how they might extend the ways in which they observe, engage, map, draw space.
You work with a lot of different artists, Jules told us already. Maybe you describe a bit about your network.
Well, since the 70s and since the social model of disability, there's been a development of disabled artists having the opportunities and the voices and funding, really, to develop their practice. And that's grown a lot. Around 2012, just before then, we started working as Architecture Inside Out, but around 2012, with the Paralympics and the Cultural Olympiad programme, because opportunities have opened and people are actually listening and engaging and pushing funding to disabled artists, a lot of those artists went off, didn't they, doing a lot of other projects, live, real projects, which was fantastic. And it's now we're really beginning to work. Those people have been away and developed their practice quite a lot, and a lot of those people are now coming back and working with us. And, you know, we've kept in touch with those people as they've been developing their practice in different ways and in different countries and with different people. And I think those people now have, I don't know, really begun to understand about architecture, built environment space. They're very aware of mapping spaces, using their creative techniques to do that. So that might be using drawing or illustration to map spaces, but to have a discussion and engagement about it. It might be using binaural sound. So we work with Joseph Young quite a lot. He uses, he'll work around mapping and thinking about the spaces through the sounds that you hear in those spaces, and that binaural sound. So it seems like it's real, that you're actually there. And it just develops really good dialogue and good conversations. And I think of some of the other artists we've worked with, they've been working in the architecture schools, they've been listening to the type of approaches the tutors and the students are using. They're beginning to see where the gaps are. So they're developing their practice in different ways. So they're much richer than, say, 10 years ago, I think, when we started, isn't it, Joss? And it's one thing me and Joss have been talking about, and it's trying to get funding so that we can... because through some of the projects, we've worked with disabled artists and architects and brought them together to work in teams, only small teams, of sort of four, sort of two architects and two disabled artists, to develop live projects. And it's then beginning to understand... You know, artists have a different language to architects and maybe designers, but if you can begin to understand the language between you, you can just begin to make better decisions about how you might create something. And I think one of the things I've really observed is that it is about that collaboration. So me as a disabled artist, you know, I might have an opinion and a way of doing things, but working with an architect, and if the two of you can reflect and develop your practice together, then the outcome is much better for both of you, really. And that's been... We've had chance, haven't we, I think, to be able to develop that. And now we're trying to capture it. And just you can probably talk about, because we're capturing it a lot more, aren't we, to try and understand what works, what doesn't work, what needs developing further.
But I think it's interesting to hear from us that you're always learning somehow, because we have the feeling that actually through all the interviews and input we had, it's always about collaboration somehow. And how do you... Like when you create those space where the students and the artists can work together, I think we were quite interested about the infrastructure, and you talked about the snowballing effect, like that actually in order to make this space, you need fundings, you need a good network of people that are engaged with it, and maybe you can tell us a bit more about it and about like how broad you are, like you're not London-centric somehow, but somehow... You've been working in many, many universities, and you have artists from everywhere.
Yeah, I mean, I think the network of disabled artists, what's been fantastic for me about that is that as Zoe mentioned, people who were involved in the very early days, when we said we want to get this going again, you know, really seriously, they were everybody, pretty well everybody was like, yay, we want to do this, we want to do this again. And then part of that is obviously beginning to expand those networks. So, for example, in the Manchester situation, our aim is to enable artists who haven't worked with us before to try it out, to see whether they want to work this way. Mm. And then we've had a core group, well, it's been an expanding core group of educators and practitioners who really are interested, you know, they come to us and they're really interested in doing this and they're really interested in co-design. So, and that core group expands. We often have events where we invite other people in. We've got students who've been involved in earlier projects who then come and help on other projects. There's somebody who runs first year now at the University of Brighton who's just worked with Rachel Gadsden, who's one of the artists from Disordinary. She does many other things as well. And that's somebody who was a student on one of the very first projects we did, which was called Sense of Place, which was about students learning to talk about buildings in a way where they were describing them to blind and visually impaired people, so they were really observing properly, and at the same time they were learning a lot about what it is that blind and visually impaired people already know. So having had that experience, she's now in this different position and she's immediately saying, I want to do more of that. So it's just very, it's kind of that snowballing, I think, is good. We also, we're getting quite a lot of, we're beginning to get more work internationally.
Oh, definitely, yes.
Copenhagen, we've been doing some stuff with the British Council in Italy and in
Armenia.
So we're beginning to look at other places for funding and other ways of organising. And I think longer term, I've been travelling a lot this summer and met some really interesting disabled artists. So longer term, the aim would be to work internationally also with artists based in those places to kind of extend that way as well. So there's a lot of possibilities.
Yes, yeah. And I think one of the, I mean, the funding it and all of that is quite hard work, because it's still an area that we have to fight quite hard to get change to happen. And, you know, money doesn't just appear, does it? It's very much about trying to, you know, work with organisations like Arts Council England to encourage them to fund the processes, because there's a lot of learning going on, a lot of development for those artists to go and work in professional practice, really. I think that's the interesting bit, isn't it? And to develop their careers and develop their opportunities as well. It's also working with the universities, who are quite supportive, aren't they, with different trust funds and things connected to those that look at research and methodology. So it's about all of those ways of doing things as well. I mean, we have noticed that people will want to commission us to do projects, but often it's still so badly funded that we're just not prepared really to underpay disabled artists to work on those projects. And that's still there, isn't it, that we really have to push to make sure that people are paid properly as professionals. It's not just about disabled artists, you know, sort of being available any time to give their opinion for free.
Often happens to disabled people, doesn't it?
Yeah.
It's assumed that you're not doing anything, so you can volunteer.
Yes, so you can volunteer. So that's really important to us, about how we keep the integrity of that at the core as well.
And I do. I really want to. The Bartlett School of Architecture at University College London has been a fantastic. Several people there, like Alan Penn, like Barbara Penner, have been really, Emily Stone, have been incredibly supportive, and they have been funding. We've both had research grants from them, and we've had this largish funding, you know, proper amount of funding for the Architecture Beyond Sight project. So that's been really good. And I'm currently working with an architectural practice that are really interested in developing a kind of series of related activities, and where we're negotiating whether they'll fund that as part of their practice activities. So those are the sorts of things I think we'd be looking for longer term, to move away from just having to apply for different sorts of grants and actually getting different sorts of sponsorship and more long-term embedded funds. Yes. And we're on that cusp, really. It turned out not to be so quiet.
Is it quiet when you came?
It was really quiet, because this Rubena's conference, whatever it is, obviously started.
Do you work with public funding mostly, or do you also collaborate with private enterprises?
This architecture practice is the first, I would say, the first private, you know, commercial funding. I don't know what the situation is with you, but here a lot of architectural practices just don't have, you know, their profit margins are pretty small. This particular practice is not in that situation, but they really don't. There are various practices who they were involved in the early days and they still have a real interest in what we do, but they don't really have any money. And I find that when we get asked to do, you know, continuing professional development type work, it's almost invariably a lunchtime lecture, that's it, and no money. So that's a hard, it's a hard market just because, and it's true, they don't have, they're struggling at the moment in the current financial climate. They don't have any spare.
No, but I mean, I think in some ways, the fact that we've captured quite a lot now and we've tested different methodologies and we're developing the thinking quite seriously, and because other things are happening. So I've seen something recently, and we've been saying this for a long time, you know, it would be great if London was the most accessible city in the world and tackled this and approached this in a, you know, in a fantastic way. And the government's just, I've seen a paper recently that they are looking at the UK being the most accessible tourist destination in the world. So it's, those things will help, I think, make sure that, because we've got the theory, we've got the practical experience to help other people try and achieve to achieve those things. And it's, you know, 2025 isn't that far away, really, and an awful lot needs to happen.
But I think the role of this Paralympic in London, right, had a huge role or a huge impact here, I have a feeling. Or like,
it was massive worldwide. Yeah. I think it had a platform worldwide. I mean, the media, for example, in the UK, went into shock and meltdown because they didn't realise it was going to be so, well, that the public were going to be so interested in disabled people being part of everything. And that was quite interesting because they weren't prepared. They suddenly had to find disabled people. Yeah, they suddenly had to find disabled people that could present, that could be on shows, that could be part of the infrastructure of the BBC. I mean, they've been doing it for a while, but they hadn't seriously done it, and they were taken a little bit by surprise. And I think the public began to enjoy some of the disability programming more than they did of the other programming. And that was a really good switch. But there'd been an awful lot of work that happened before 2012 to change attitudes. And I think sometimes that's sometimes forgotten. And when we work in other countries, we say, you know, this has been going on for an awful long time prior to 2012. And that just became a fantastic catalyst and pinnacle because you had that stage, that worldwide platform to actually say we need to think differently about this.
It's kind of ironic that it's the Olympics. They kind of rely on a norm, right? There was this case of this woman who had too much testosterone. So she can't run as a woman because she was too good. And I think this raised the whole question of like, how to deal with the Olympics and like categorizing people and or this whole thing of like using what's it called
prosthetic, you know,
and then runners can be faster even, so it's like techno doping.
One of the things that comes up a lot, as you probably know, around disability is that if you're disabled, especially if you're visibly disabled, you can either be kind of a cyborg and kind of superhuman, or you're like pitiful and kind of, you know, worthless. Don't know anything about anything. And those stereotypes are incredibly powerful. They're still, you know, they're in everyday talk. They are the way people talk. And, you know, that's my experience as somebody who's non-disabled, working a lot with disabled artists and working into these spaces, is how much those stereotypes hold just kind of people's normal way of talking. And one of the things we do is challenge that as often as possible. And again, it's this thing about starting from difference. So to give an example, one of the artists that we work with, David Dixon, he has a prosthetic leg, and he does a project which he's done two or three times now called Alterator, which is about the idea that rather than seeing him as either superhuman or, you know, sort of sad case, that it's just difference is just interesting for its own right. So it's about that, and he gets people to alter their bodies in random ways, and then draw differently. So, I mean, you draw differently because you've altered your body, and look at the kind of creativity and the enthusiasm that comes out of those pieces of work. And it's a really lovely project. And I think you should talk about your character scenario too. I think that one works really well.
Yeah,
just to give an example.
It is about this everyday thing, you know, getting to the shops, catching the train, the bus, the, you know, walking around the corner, going to the pub, you know, going out clubbing, doing all these things that everybody else does, really. And it was through thinking about bodies, wasn't it, in a different way. And we started trying different techniques. And I'd just been developing training. It was working in Brazil, really, for the Cultural Olympiad out there. But it was trying to get... it was museum moderators, really, and people that work in museums, to think how disabled people coming into the museum environment might work in different ways. So I started to look at how they... as a training exercise, really, about them being different characters. And those characters not necessarily being disabled people, but being somebody that was carrying very heavy shopping, somebody walking through the building incredibly slowly, people moving very fast, people hopping, people sliding along the floor. And then it was about what was that experience like? And the one that seems to work really well is people moving through the building very slowly. So people start to actually engage with the space a lot more. They begin to understand what's not working in that space. They begin to understand that you might be left out from the group because you can't move as fast as everybody else. So it just starts a whole new conversation.
But it also has some positives in it too. I think what's really lovely about those exercises is people say they really loved just doing things much more
reflecting
slowly and reflecting.
Yeah.
And so they had this, everybody through these different exercises had this really interesting mixture.
Well, it was a jump, wasn't it, from thinking how these things don't work to thinking, actually, I've rather than rushing through the space, I've begun to see that that the textures or the smells or the environment, there's things that are really interesting here. Observing other people's quite interesting, or there are places to sit down that may have not been designed into the building, but actually we could design more in quite interesting ways to make the building more better for everybody, really. So that's been, it's been really great, hasn't it, to see that. So we've developed those different characters more and more, and I think we will continue to do that.
Yeah, we've used that in different ways. And again, I just to reiterate that point about, because it's very easy for people just to want to put disabled people in these different functional categories. It's like, this is what you need if you use a wheelchair, or this is what you need if you're blind, or this is what you need if you're autistic. And by doing these kinds of activities, these kind of character scenarios, you're not performing any of those, you're not performing a category, but you're performing a way of being in the world which is connects to a whole range of impairments and connects to the enjoyment of difference. Really.
It also seems to connect to the individual, doesn't it? Because suddenly they say, right, I really begin to understand this now. And they seem to just approach this idea of the whole space in a very different way. And it becomes something they can connect to, not a...
It's almost because it is embodied.
Thing.
It's like you do it in an embodied way, so you remember it in an embodied way, not like an intellectual understanding.
And I was quite... and I wrote a little bit about it, but at the University of Westminster, I tried it probably about the third time I tried it, and with the students, and I did it slightly differently. And they quite went into shock after doing it and coming back and reflecting. And it was really interesting to see such a huge change from not having thought about this to within 20, 25 minutes beginning to... you could see they could very quickly start to think how they were going to design things in a different way. And I just thought, it doesn't take a lot. I mean, it's taken a lot of time to develop it, hasn't it? but actually, when you start to have those conversations and you try things out... You can get people to stop doing this obsessive thing, can't you, about the myths or the characteristics of an impairment and how that might, because of all the things you've been told, you can begin to just throw that out the window, really, and start thinking very differently about it.
Thank you very much.
Yeah.
Is that right?
Maybe I have one question we didn't ask. It was more about references or model or people that inspired you. Or...
The person who I'm most impressed with is Zoe Partington. Because what was really fantastic for me, having been interested in thinking about how we might think about access and inclusion differently in architecture, is it seemed really hard, like with feminism, when you're talking about gender, you know, there are women around, you can do that, there's women in practice. With disability, disabled people, although there are lots of disabled people in architectural practice and education, they're isolated, they often hide it because it affects the possibility of work or the possibility of study. So this notion, which came entirely to me from Zoe, from other work that she's been doing, about working with disabled artists, it was out of work that you'd already been developing, just seemed like a really inventive way forward. It just seemed like such a rich way to go, because you had this, all our early discussions, you had this equivalence of creativity. You were having discussions which were as much about art practice as they were, and architectural practice as they were about disability. Yeah. You suddenly shifted the kind of where the discussion was had. So for me, that's vital.
Yeah. I think working in places like the Joint Mobility Unit, which was a charitable organisation that looked at accessibility, and Peter Barker was in charge of that unit, was a blind... He came from the construction industry, Peter. So he had a very methodical way and did do guidance. And I absolutely loved working with him, and he did make me think about things in a very different way. But I was still quite frustrated with how things still didn't seem to shift enough. And then I met quite a lot of very radical disabled artists who definitely thought very differently about it all. And people like Barbara Lisicki, people like Alan Holdsworth, and people like Liz Crowe, seeing their practice and the way that they worked really made me sharpen up, I think, and address some of the mistakes that I was definitely making, to really start to, to start to observe and look at what... It's quite fascinating, isn't it, what doesn't work? And I think as a disabled artist, you start to... Well, that's your practice, is about what doesn't work, and you can look at that and create things from it. And I just think it's that whole combination, isn't it, of being able to talk to people. I mean, I also talked to Joss as well, because I had a sort of history of architecture background, but I didn't necessarily understand the whole spatial issue of people moving through the spaces and how architects were taught, I suppose. So that was great as well, because that made me be able to think about my practice, think about artist practice, and then think about how we might engage with architects and designers in very different ways. The way I was talking wasn't about moaning about a space, it was about having a discussion and a discourse, wasn't it, really, about those spaces.
And having a creative way forward too, I think, not just saying it doesn't work.
Yeah, and realising the strength in all parties, really, to when you've talked about that, about collaborating, that is how you get things to move, really. But, I mean, you know, it's still hard work, because people don't want to hear it often.
Yeah, have to scream.
Yeah, and you have to find techniques for things. You know, I get to all sorts of things. You know, they're supporting some disability initiative, and then you sort of look around the room and you think, there's no disabled people in here.
Yeah.
Or they haven't even got they've got steps into the auditorium. Yeah. Yeah. They really haven't thought this through.
Yeah. Once you start noticing that stuff, you can't unnotice it. And that's the important thing, is to start noticing it. How many spaces you go into that are not even basically accessible. You know,
and I think Amy Hanway was fantastic, wasn't it? Because she just naturally audio describes every image she puts up when she's doing a talk. So many people don't do that. They have no awareness, do they, that other people in the room might not be able to see what's on the screen. And I think, you know, little things like... If modules were, I don't know, for teachers or lecturers, if all those things were built into stuff, then people wouldn't be excluded quite so much.
And I do, I mean, I also, just because you were mentioning Amy Hamray, I think that one of the things that's been great is that we've been able to bring her here from the States, and that there is, I've mentioned disability studies several times, and I do think there's fantastic work going on in that subject area that doesn't penetrate into our... I mean... Stuff around gender and race and sexuality does, little bits of it, it depends where you study and what you're interested in, but there's literature on that that's within architecture as a discipline. You can read it, particularly around gender. There's a whole history of that stuff around race. There's less of it that's very specifically about architecture. But disability studies, which has been talking about architecture for years, through people like Amy Hamray or, well, or somebody like Liz Crowe, who was writing about feminism and disability in the 1980s, you know, has been around a very long time and very, very knowledgeable and very creative in this area. There's texts out there, there's stuff out there, which I've found, because I do a lot of the, I do that kind of writing them all. I'm kind of, my role is to influence at the academic end, and Zoe's experience is very much, and knowledge is very much at, in terms of kind of direct expertise into practice and into yeah. kind of policy. But I have found people like Amy Hamray, like Alison Kafer, who I mentioned, like Jay Dormage, like Tanya Tuskovsky. There's a whole gang of them. And a disability activist like the Disability Visibility Project, who I've mentioned before, and who have a, you know, their whole campaign at the moment is called Access is Love. It's a really different way of thinking about access. It's about how you, everybody has a responsibility to make spaces more accessible, and it's around care and collaboration. And it's beautiful. So there's stuff there which I think would be very energising for architecture as a discipline. Mm-hmm. And I don't quite see why it seems so hard. You know, Zoe was talking about how hard it is to actually change attitudes, but it's also incredibly hard to get that those kinds of references just as part of the everyday life of architecture schools and practice, and they should be. They're fantastic.
This was the F Podcast, and we are the FEMART Collective.